Stansted conference room and some excellent refreshments. And I'd like to thank Steve Shepherd, who isn't here because he's still nursemaiding some latecomers, who's our host. And without Steve, the forum wouldn't be taking place. I hope that those of you listening to this session via podcast are in similarly convivial surroundings and that you enjoy the program. The format for the session is simple. In a few moments, I'll introduce our guest, Darren Bilsborough. Those of us here will listen to Darren for perhaps 45 minutes, after which the recording will cease and we'll engage in a conversation between Darren and ourselves about his thoughts and ideas. I hope that those listening to this via podcast will also use the recording to stimulate discussions among your friends and colleagues, because that's the real reason these forums exist, to explore ideas about what would make Australia a better place. So our theme tonight is cities. Many of you will know that Australia is one of the most urbanised countries in the world, and hence it's quite appropriate that our theme is the role of cities in creating Australia's future. To stimulate our thinking, we've invited Darren Bilsborough, who's Director of Urban Innovation at global architecture firm Woods Bagot, based in Adelaide. He's also Adjunct Professor of Sustainability at the Curtin University Sustainability Policy Institute, and a director of the Green Building Council of Australia. Those who are members of the Futures Foundation might remember that Darren wrote the lead story, The State of Australian Cities in 2013, An Urban Innovation Response, in the December edition of our Future News magazine. Darren is here tonight to build on the ideas in that article and to stimulate our thinking on the issue. Darren, welcome, and over to you.
Thank you, Charles. So I've entitled this Future Urban Renewal as an Economic Accelerator. One of the issues that I love to speak about when I talk about sustainability topics, in fact, I think I've taken sustainability as a word off most of the slides that are up there, is really about how it relates to the not only the triple bottom line, but the things that people want to hear. And I guess from a policy setting perspective, most of the time the discussions I wanted to be around the economics, so that's why I called it what I have. A couple of challenges, and this was referred to in that little article that Charles just referred to. Two main ones, I think, for cities is the environmental challenges and the resource challenges that are coming forward. And the second one is the issues around population, population increases and future health liabilities. What are we going to do with these people and how are we going to continue to satisfy their needs? You probably all have heard of the CSIRO megatrends. They had five megatrends and it's become six megatrends last year. So that's each of the six. I'll just briefly go through them all. I guess the more from less is one that I love to speak about often from a sustainability perspective, so it's really about resource efficiencies. The going, going, gone, you're going to hear a lot about in this presentation from me as well. That's about loss of ecological habitat, as well as biodiversity loss. There's also the issue around climate change and increase in CO2 emissions that's captured by that particular megatrend. The Silk Highway, so recognising the growing economic powers from Brazil, Russia, China and India. Forever Young, so that recognising that we've got a significantly changing demographic, which poses all sorts of interesting challenges moving forward, not only from the perspective of health and paying for that health, reductions in taxpayer base, but also in relation to housing and transport. Great expectations, a real shift from people, from products to services and experiences. And the last one virtually here, so that's just recognising the effects of the digital world that we all currently live in, which is changing the way we do everything, basically. A few years ago, the World Economic Forum did a piece of work around mega shocks. In this particular presentation, there was something like 30-odd or 40-odd shocks that they were predicting in the future that were potentially going to create all sorts of issues for us to rise to. This particular presentation will touch a little tiny bit on the oil and gas spikes the extreme weather element, and but particularly the biodiversity loss one, which I mentioned before. Future health liabilities. This graph that I have on the screen here is an old one from the intergenerational report from 2010. There's been an updated version of that last year, but the trend is exactly the same. What it shows that is that there's a huge health liability as we project forward. It's something like an increase of 5% of the current GDP by 2020. And currently there are no policies or strategies in place that I'm aware of in any part of politics, state or federal, to take into account that we've got this future health liability in front of us. And I'll keep coming back to this because it's a key theme for my presentation. There's a whole host of challenges, I guess, and this little graphic was an attempt to try and put them all on one slide. Productivity growth is in decline. You would have often heard that from the federal politicians. The demographics, as I mentioned, there's huge changes, the future health liabilities that I mentioned. Climate change issues, population growth, projected to be 50% growth by 2050. So where are we going to put all of these people? And housing affordability way down. So I'll try and touch on each of these elements as I go through the presentation. And how urban renewal and how cities need to respond to them, I guess, is the whole point of my presentation. So this is really just a reminder of the economic relevance of cities. And I think Charles mentioned that as part of his introduction that almost 8 in every 10 of us live in cities, in the major cities. Australia is an urbanised nation. It's well over 90% of people living within urban locations. But at least 80% of our GDP is also produced within our cities. So all of the stuff that we hear about resources and agriculture and all the rest of it is not necessarily where the major drivers are within our economy. It actually results from inside our cities. A few years ago, you may recall our former Prime Minister, this is going back to Kay Rudd's days, I believe, where he started a mantra of the three Ps, of productivity, population and participation. Participation, productivity, population, or whichever way he put it, was the three elements that he felt were extremely important to the future prosperity of Australia, was how we would deal with each of those individually. And again, I'll keep coming back to those as a key theme of what I'm talking about. As I said before, whenever I talk about sustainability, it's always about the economics of what's happening. There are, of course, the other elements of the triple bottom line of environment and social, but I think if you get the economic policy levers right in thinking about some of those other elements, they almost take care of themselves. And you'll see that through at least my propositions anyway, they'll take care of themselves. A couple of quotes that I really loved that I guess provide a bit of context to what cities are all about. The first one from Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York City. Today, our greatest competitive advantages are the qualities that attract the best and brightest from around the world to come here. And the second one from Ed Glaser, who wrote a book called Triumph of the City in 2011. Cities aren't structures, cities are people. The strength that comes from human collaboration is the central truth behind civilization's success and the primary reason why cities exist. Both of those quotes point to cities being economic drivers, and there's a whole lot of research that's been done that talk about creativity and innovation and all of these other wonderful things that we'd love to see, and cities being the very hub of that. Some time ago, I co-authored a paper with Professor Peter Newman from Curtin University, and we wrote the paper around a Western Australian government's initiative for Pilbara cities. And the reason we wrote that particular paper was because the WA government said they'd love to see 100,000 people in the Pilbara. Currently, I think there's 10,000 to 15,000 people in Karratha and the same number of people in Port Hedland. And when he initially raised that as a potential prospect, there was an awful lot of people that wanted to put up barriers and say, it just can't be done. So Peter and I decided that we would sit down and write a paper that was way more positive, that was about saying, hey, this would actually be pretty cool if it could happen. There'd be a whole lot of benefits economically, and socially and potentially environmentally as well, if we were able to get the levers right and the policies right to enable it to happen. So we wrote a paper around how that might be able to occur. Now, this presentation is not about the actions that we talked about for Pilbara Cities, but what popped out of it was four themes for building what we wanted. Resilient cities was basically the theme that we talked about, but good cities. And those four themes were the importance of economic development and diversity. Now, obviously, that's a key problem with the Pilbara. Infrastructure, both social and physical infrastructure, and planning and placemaking being number three. And number four is governance, whether that be at regional, state or federal level. So those four themes were all important. Get those right, then you potentially can create some great outcomes. In this presentation, I wanted to concentrate on two of them. The first one being infrastructure. So again, it's about the social and physical components of infrastructure. So I like to call on the body and the organs of cities and towns. As you can see, I'm talking about energy, I'm talking about health, justice, there's a whole host of issues. And good infrastructure, whether it's both social and physical, is all in support of place. And I'm going to come back and talk about place. Quite often I'm going to refer to place as an outcome that is going to deliver really, really good triple bottom line outcomes. And the second one is the planning and placemaking again. So again, place. But the next part is the planning component of it. So I'm going to talk quite a lot about what we might be able to do to think about how our cities should be planned to get the sort of outcomes that we want to try and achieve. This was an interesting little piece of research that I picked up on some years ago, talking about the temporal scale of planning. So there's a whole host of issues that occur over quite a long period of time. You know, if we look at those graphs for the people that can't see them, urban land use planning, there's a 20-year horizon for something like that. Infrastructure, similarly. Solid waste management, transport planning, it's a 10-year horizon to think about all of those things, which is an awful long time. But what's even worse is how long the effects actually occur from each of those decisions that are made along the way. So one could argue that they're almost too short, some of those planning processes or temporal timeframes, when you think about the fact that, you know, urban land use planning in this particular piece of research says it's got a 1,000-year impact. So, and when you look at some of the European cities in particular, it's quite easy to actually see the impacts over that period of time. Here in Australia, I'll talk a little bit more about urban sprawl pretty soon, but you'll see that there's a few hundred years worth of impact in relation to some of the decisions that have been made over time and moving away from rail and light rail and tram systems. You guys in Melbourne are lucky that you didn't get rid of them all like we have in every other major city in Australia. But huge, the impacts that's created, and I will talk about some of that in more detail. I wanted to talk about this little piece as well. Coming back to place, I'm going to keep coming back to place because I think it's quite important. There was a really interesting piece of research that was done in the US some years ago. 28,000 people were interviewed across 26 communities. And the central theme of it was the question of, well, what binds people to place? What actually makes them stay there? There's a whole lot of reasons why they might go there. Often it's about jobs and it's about, falling in love and following a partner, or, you know, it could be all sorts of, well, I like the idea at the time, whatever the case might be. There's a lot of different reasons for people going there. But what actually binds people to place? And the three main elements that come up out of that interview process was social offerings. So by that, I mean entertainment, venues, places to meet, places to go, those sorts of things. I mean, Melbourne's a fantastic example of an enormous variety of social offerings. It makes me want to come and live here. The openness, how welcoming a place can be, was one of the three major reasons that people said that keeps them in that particular place. I don't mean to offend anybody, particularly those that are listening, but it's one of the reasons probably I wouldn't want to live in Sydney. Aesthetics is the third one. So that's the beauty. That's one of the reasons why you would go to Sydney, I guess, is that it's actually quite a beautiful environment to be within. And also the green spaces, and you'll see that that's a common theme as well. I'll keep popping back to that one as well. So where to from here? What's the next wave? This slide talks about the waves of innovation, which was an idea that generated from the Natural Edge project, which is talking about technological waves of innovation that have occurred that have seen a subsequent increase in well-being and the benefits to society, the wealth being generated by society. So if you go through the first wave of iron, water power, textiles, second wave steam power, railroads, third electrical chemicals, internal combustion engine, fourth petrochemicals, electronics, space. Fifth, the one that we're riding still, I think, that says that we're actually coming off the back of it, but I think we're still riding the digital wave, and suggesting that the last one might be related to sustainability. So whether it's sustainability, whether it's things like resource efficiency, which is one of those mega trends that CSIRO have identified, whether it's biodiversity loss and those issues that again CSIRO have identified. So I think you can find that there's a number of ideas there, renewables, green nanotechnology, biomimicry, which is an interesting one. I don't know, for those that don't know what biomimicry is, the idea of biomimicry is that it's how do we replicate what's happening in nature. So for example, the strength of a spider's web is greater than tensile steel, for example. So how do we actually go through a process of creating these fantastic materials without the sort of wastes that we generate that aren't necessarily good for the environment? So that's what biomimicry is all about. So better cities, that's really what we want to try and achieve. Better and smarter cities. So what constitutes a better city? I went through a process some years ago in leading a CRC bid, and we were trying to define what a better city was as part of our pitch, I guess, to the federal government to try and get some research funds. And these are the sorts of things that we come up with. One is that it was economically resilient and productive, which gets back to those four themes that I was talking about before. One that attracts business and financial capital. Again, I'm going to keep coming back to economics all the time. I think that is a real pointer to whether or not you've got a successful city. One is that is resource efficient and waste-free. No point having a terrific city that's dirty and full of pollution and all the rest of it. Beijing's obviously gone through that in Shanghai and still struggling with how to turn all of that around. But it stops them from becoming as good a city as they can be. But they're working on that sort of stuff. One that attracts people and enriches social capital. So again, that goes back to some of that thinking around that binding people to place piece of research that I mentioned. One that binds people to place. One that's socially inclusive, so safe, just, and affordable. All of those things are really important. It's that sort of diversity that there's lots of research that points to points to innovation and creativity and like, particularly some of the work from Richard Florida. One in which all stakeholders can engage in its future. I think that's pretty important as well. I think it's the sort of thing that stops Singapore from being as good as what it could be, for example. And I used to live in Singapore. I love Singapore, but there are some downsides to it. A place that promotes the health and well-being of its occupants. I think that's really important, and I'm going to try and show a much stronger connection to that element through some of the stuff that I'm going to talk about how cities are being built. And that's why I've got in a little note there about land use and transport planning. So I'll make that connection much stronger for you as we go through this. So we need a new model for innovative planning. I think that sort of stuff I probably was in the little flyer that talked about. And so I'm going to, everything that I talk about is you can, it's around development at a precinct scale. And when I say precinct scale, that can be anything from a city block all the way through to a whole new city. So there's almost nothing that I'm not talking about in relation to precinct scale developments. The only thing I'm probably not talking about is just, a single development, like maybe a casino, for example. It might have multiple buildings, but it's not really a precinct in my view. I mentioned before the CRC bid that we went through, there was quite a lot of research that was undertaken, a lot of interviews that were done with property professionals from around Australia before we sat down and tried to articulate what it was that we were going to do. And it was essentially asking everybody who was involved in the built environment what the major problems were and how they might be able to fix it. And that little Wordle diagram that you see up there is all the words and all the responses that we got from an enormous number. I think it was something like 900 participants that were part of that survey. And you can see quite clearly the design came out as the number one issue that people felt that there was an opportunity through a process of design to resolve some of the complex problems that we were facing, some of those ones that we saw earlier. And we wrote a little book called The Book of Wicked Problems, which was really about trying to, again, write down what all of these issues are and how we might go about solving them, but particularly being outcome-focused, so ensuring that there was an outcome that we'd identified and that was where we wanted to go to. Interestingly, design has also been raised by the last federal government, the previous federal government, in their Australia in the Asian Century white paper. That was talking about how do Australian organisations engage with Asia and how they might be able to derive economic benefit for themselves. And one of the little nuggets that came out of that was that, quote, was using creativity and design-based thinking to solve complex problems as a distinctive Australian strength that can help to meet the emerging challenges of this century. And I thought that was really quite powerful, not only because it backed up what I've been banging on about, but I thought there were some interesting synergies there with us as a nation, who we are, and out the unique opportunities that we might have to be able to sell our services elsewhere. So I'll talk a little bit more about how that relates to cities. Urban innovation, my role within Woods Bagot is Director of Urban Innovation. I coined it because I didn't want to be called Director of Sustainability, but basically it was thinking about, well, how might we do things differently? How do we get these better city outcomes that we're trying to get? And I went through a whole host of looking, trying to define what it might be. Marriage of culture and technology to solve urban and spatial problems, and I ended up landing with integrated design solutions that maximise value to built form and minimise risk to future urban resilience. And I thought that was a succinct way, even if it might be a little bit sort of wordy, a succinct way of trying to describe what it was that I meant when I said urban innovation. So let's have a look at what some of those urban innovations might be. What sort of responses might we require? Green buildings, and in this perspective, I'm thinking about green buildings, the next steps to green buildings. Green buildings have had a tremendous... they've really landed quite well over the last 10 years. As Charles mentioned, I'm former director of the Green Building Council, and... we've seen an enormous amount of growth in relation to that stuff over the years. But one of the questions that keeps coming back to me is, well, what's the next step in the process? One of them is more of the innovative technologies that we've seen being utilised elsewhere around the world. In this particular instance, it's building integrated PV. A lot of those images are from Germany. But there are an enormous number of opportunities and applications for integrating PV within buildings, not just setting them on our residential roofs, which is what we currently do. The real answer, I guess, from a sustainability perspective, if you wanted to get quite narky about it all, is to say, well, we don't really need too many new buildings. We need some to deal with increases in population. But quite frankly, when you're thinking about the issues of resources efficiency and sustainability, we'd be better off not building any new buildings. We'd be better off actually refurbishing all of our existing buildings and bringing them up to the kind of standards that we'd like to see. The Green Building Council have recently released a new tool around existing buildings to sort of help promote that sort of turnaround in the building stock. And there's lots of other policies that are shifting around Australia in an attempt to upgrade existing building stock, because it's seen as a real problem. 97% of our building stock is existing, not green. So how do we go about dealing with that sort of stuff? Housing affordability is another big issue. I've put the caption up there, affordability takes many forms. One of the things that continually frustrates me around the housing affordability debate is how narrow it is. It talks about the cost of housing. It doesn't talk about the cost of transport. If you start building a house on the fringes of one of the major cities, whether that be Melbourne or Sydney or Brisbane, not so much Adelaide, only takes 10 minutes to get anywhere, not true. It takes a little bit longer, but it's not quite as bad as elsewhere. But interestingly, in the Adelaide Advertiser a few years ago, around the time of the GFC, there was a picture on the front page of the paper of a lady, and she was complaining about, and she had her car in the background. It was a Pajero, big four-wheel drive. And she was complaining about how, for the first time in her memory, the cost of her fuel was equal to the cost of her mortgage. And she lived quite a way south, obviously, of the city and had to drive into the city every day. So household affordability was probably much more relevant. This graph shows that, you know, not only in amongst all of that stuff, the sizes of our houses continue to grow in Australia as well. There's a lot of research that's been done. This one from Professor Peter Newman, again, indicating that sprawling places are more expensive. The further away that you are, the more cost to the household income there is. There's another one demonstrating density versus private transport. And as you can guess, the less dense a place is, more sprawling that it is, the more need there is to use a car as opposed to public transport. All of these things are related. Here's another one, just showing that not only are our houses continuing to grow, that they're the largest in the world. So what is it in relation to our expectations that seems to continue to push down this pathway of creating the biggest houses in the world? I remember I was fortunate enough to go to one of the G'day LA events some years ago, the Australian government in doing a whole lot of presentations in California and Hollywood, as a matter of fact, which was all a lot of fun. Talking about this one particular one was an energy dialogue, and during the course of the question and answers with the guys over there, I made mention of the fact that Australia actually now, and I said, oh, look, this is nothing to be particularly proud of, but we now have the biggest houses in the world, and they would not believe me. It would not matter how many times I kept saying it, or, you know, look, I'll show you the research, all that. They said, no way in the world could you guys have the biggest houses in the world. We got them here, right here in California. Sorry you don't. But it's a problem, and as I say, there's an expectation issue there. Oops. There's also some interesting moves towards affordable housing models at the moment. But again, this is just concentrating on cost of housing. As it so turns out, though, these ones also happen to be in locations generally where they're close to public transport. They're obviously smaller, and there's density attached to it. Guess what? They're more affordable. Gee, what a surprise. Sustainable transport is another pathway, I guess, another part of the process to go through. So what do I mean by that? I mean rail and public transport, bicycling, green cars, and how infrastructure needs to be designed to actually take into account all of those things. And then just a number of the different options available, whether it's hybrids, whether it's electric assistant bikes, scooters, and the like. This is an interesting little cartoon I found some years ago. I often use this when talking about climate change. If you want a big opportunity, look for a big problem. And for those that are listening and not seeing, there's a polar bear sitting on a little tiny piece of ice in front of an oil platform, and the guys on the platform are saying, now that fossil fuel use has melted the ice cap, we can drill for more fossil fuels. So there is opportunity associated with just about any problem. So let's explore one of those. There's a profile of Australia's emissions. And you'll see that there's it has a number of the sectors, the greatest one being stationary energy. But funnily enough, stationary energy and transport, when you put two together, which are the two largest parts of our emission profile, are in fact 62% of all of our emissions. So if we put together sustainable energy with our transport platform, and then we look at what sort of things are happening elsewhere overseas with electric vehicles in particular and renewable communities, it doesn't take that long to start thinking about, well, what if there's a possibility of actually integrating all of those elements and using the batteries that exist within cars as storage for renewable power, because obviously the naysayers continue to say that the problem with renewable power is that it's generated at times where we don't actually use the power. So the only solution to do that is to store it. So what if we used our cars to store the energy? Interestingly, when you look at the profile of how far we drive our cars normally, these days the batteries in electric cars are good for something like 200 kilometres. So there's a significant amount of storage available, but we only do 30 to 40 kilometres a day. That's a Japanese graph, but it's exactly the same in Sydney, and I think it's even less in Melbourne, and probably less still in Adelaide and elsewhere. So if you pose the question, well, what if we actually replaced all of the cars in Australia with electric vehicles, what would happen? Well, interestingly, we'd actually have three times our current generation capacity, 300% of what we currently have as power available to the grid. So it's quite interesting proposition to think about if we started using electric vehicles as part of our power supply and power demands. Then raises all sorts of interesting scenarios that I've tried to pose to people before. Let's think of a car park rather than think of it as a car park. Let's think of it as a power generator. Gosh, I'm not sure I can wrap my head around that, but you can see that there's a whole lot of different potential opportunities available. And there's a little graph demonstrating what might happen. Green cars aren't really the answer, though, because although at the moment there's still obviously quite a small component of the overall marketplace, it's going to take a long time and a lot of money to completely shift the entire market across to electric vehicles. But more importantly, it actually doesn't address congestion, doesn't address the impacts of accidents, doesn't really address the issues associated with mobility for the aged, or obesity, or any of these other elements that we need to deal with, and we talked about as far as future health liabilities anyway. There has, though, been some moves, certainly worldwide. Land use and transport is inextricably linked. In South Australia, the government has just been going through a land use and transport, integrated land use and transport strategy. I haven't seen the outcome of exactly what that all means yet, but there's a lot of thinking going around there. I think the Victorian government has been doing similar things. Those two states tend to be a little bit in front of the game compared to the others when it comes to this sort of level of thinking. But there has been some real changes and shifts. In the US, there's referred to the road diet up there, that there's been moves to tear down roads to try and reduce the number of expressways and the like, and to shift those people onto public transport linkages, and obviously providing more road space for bicycles and the like as well. And there's just some indications of those shifts in public transport are actually happening, even around Australia at the moment. They're pretty small still. The numbers are big, the percentages are big, but the overall numbers of people using public transport is still pretty small in Australia. So what does sustainable built form and land use mean? Well, it obviously means fewer cars, less roads, more public transport, pedestrian and cycling priorities. Apologies to anybody that drives a Volvo. I couldn't think of anything better for a Volvo than for it to be sitting there like that. I found this in Christchurch. It was the Petrol Engine Memorial Park for mourning the oil era and its victims. This was before the earthquakes in Christchurch, but I thought it was such a beautiful representation of all the things that not only that I have talked about, but I'm going to talk about. I'll just briefly refer to this little one, only because I love the irony attached to this. This is an expressway in Seoul. And what happened was that it was actually built over a river, a stream, and it was quite sacred to the people of South Korea, this particular stream. Now, as you can see from that picture, you can't even see it. And so what happened was that a mayor came to office and he said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tear down the expressway and I'm going to restitute this back to the stream, and we're going to enjoy it, and all of our families are going to enjoy it, and as we have been doing for generations, and as we should. And that's an artist's impression, but it's pretty close to what it actually really looks like. He achieved it. Now, a couple of really interesting things out of this. The first one, of course, is that everybody said, well, you can't do that because what will happen to all the cars? And the funniest thing is about all of these road diets, it doesn't matter what you do, the cars just disappear. They just, no one can find them again. Same thing happened in Melbourne when the city of Melbourne decided to shift or change all of the streets from two-way streets to single-lane streets and brought in the footpaths and all that. No one could actually work out where all the cars went. They just honestly disappear. It's like the Bermuda Triangle of transport problems. They just disappear. But, of course, the transport engineers keep telling you we need more of these big roads everywhere, so that because there's just too many cars and we just need to put on. But as soon as you actually build one, they get filled with cars. Well, funnily enough, if you tear them down, they just disappear. The other interesting thing about this story was that the guy that got elected as mayor on the basis that he was going to tear it down ended up being, I think, the president of South Korea or something similar to that. But what a lot of people don't know is actually the project engineer that built it in the first place. How's that for the ultimate irony? I thought that was just beautiful. He's found an entire career, you know, political and otherwise, due to that expressway. So just a couple of images in relation to cycling. It's definitely catching on. One of the real problems, though, with cycling, and I'm not sure whether it's true here in Melbourne like it is in Adelaide, but there is. I think here it's a little bit better, but there's almost no physical distinction between where the cars can go and where the cyclists can go. So irrespective of what the government talks about in relation to, you know, we've given all these cycleways and there's lots of people can cycle, I'm a cyclist and you'd be mad to actually ride to work on some of these bicycle lanes when they're full of traffic. I do it very early in the morning when there's not so much traffic, and it's bad enough then. So a lot of these images are demonstrating, showing some physical barriers between the cars and the cyclists. And I think until we actually arrive at that as a solution, it'll be very, very difficult to continue to build the number of cyclists on our roads that we're currently at. Having said that, the numbers are building continually, but I do think that that's a major impediment. Here's another really fascinating one. This is a Swedish study showing it's a measure of how much energy it's required to move 1 gram for 1 kilometre. And as you can see, the most efficient of everything that's occurring in nature or anywhere else, anything that's man-made, is the bicycle, which I found just fascinating. And that would be a lovely circumstance. No cars, lots of beautiful trees and some density. And gee, that looks just beautiful, doesn't it? That's Vancouver, by the way. So what do we need as a tipping point? We need a transport tipping point. So that's a transport tipping point. PPPs. Previously, I used to think that the transport tipping point was potentially peak oil. I'm not sure peak oil is going to create the tipping point for us anymore. I just don't know, so I've taken that off. I leave it as a question mark. But PPPs really should be the tipping point. When I talk about PPPs, I'm referring to the same PP I mentioned before. Population, participation and productivity. They should be the things that are getting us thinking about how we require different transportation systems. Some time ago, PB Cusp Alliance, Cusp is the group that I'm an adjunct of, did a piece of research comparing the costs of development on the fringes versus the costs of inner city development. And what it demonstrated, this particular research piece of research was got a lot of airplay at the time, some years ago that we did it, but it ended up forming... it's still being used and still being referred to, and was a central plank of a number of different policy positions from various state governments and certainly the previous federal government. What we were able to demonstrate was that governments around Australia actually subsidise the urban fringe blocks by something like $80,000 per block. They subsidise it in the form, those subsidies are in the form of the physical and social infrastructure that's required to support outlying suburbs, so the schools, the police, the roads, the electricity supply systems, the sewage, etc., etc., etc. Yes, the developers have to pay, you know, charges and all of that sort of stuff, but at the end of the day, the governments themselves subsidise every single block to the tune of about $80,000. That was in 2008-09 numbers. The cost to people, we were able to show that there was a $250 million worth of transport costs over 50 years. Huge health costs associated with the risk of obesity because people had the ability to be able to walk from their kitchen to, into their garage, sit in their car, go to the car park, get out of the car park, go in the lift, go into the office, and that's about as much walking or any other exercise, incidental exercise, that they got during the course of the day. The cost of the planet, obviously, through the emissions profile of actually driving your cars to and from work all of the time. And we were able to demonstrate a 6% improvement in productivity. Again, I was trying to always keep finding these links back to the economics and back to the economic arguments all the way through. And that 6% is on the light side. It's hugely conservative. There's an awful lot of elements that we weren't able to look at because there just wasn't the evidence base for us to be able to draw the numbers from. So that 6% is only on active travel lifestyle. So there's nothing in there about mental health. There's nothing in there about any of the other issues that we know can potentially be improved by, you know, having people not spend so much time sitting in cars, for instance. Sustainable. This, I love this slide. I don't know whether anyone's actually seen this slide before, but it's an opportunity slide. What it shows is the difference is the amount of land that's taken up by 177 cars versus 3 buses versus 1 tram. And you can see suddenly, if you're a developer, and I'm married to a property developer, I show her a slide like this, she goes, wow, look at all that land that potentially I could develop if we had a tram instead of all of those cars. So you can think of it, you know, we could do that. We could have economic development. We could have more housing. We could turn them into parklands. There could be amenity. It could be all sorts of things that we can do with that, with those roads that are currently, you know, go back to that South Korean example that I had before, but it's really just an opportunity slide. So what other economic opportunities might be gained through better transport and land use planning? $20 billion by 2020 is the sort of numbers that they're talking about if we can reduce congestion to levels that that are more acceptable, better access, raising productivity and social equity. Again, it's this issue of attracting business, the savings in the healthcare. I've just kind of mentioned the obesity thing a little bit and alluded to mental health. It's enormous. It's a great big barrel waiting for somebody to unpick it and identify just how much money is in there to be picked up off the floor. The energy and the greenhouse gas savings are enormous, as you can imagine. Enormous uplift in property values. Gee whiz, wouldn't it be terrific if you didn't have the highway going past your house or a major road or whatever it might be? What might that do? And the tourism opportunities, obviously, for lots of those spaces. Now, I'm running out of time, aren't I? I haven't even got to the biophilic city concept idea. Do you want me to go faster?
Yes,
all right. I'm going to fly through this bit about as quick as I can. So, biophilic city concept. What is biophilia? Basically, it's a term used to describe our innate need to connect with nature. So it's as simple as that. The basic premise is that the sea change, the tree change, it's there for a reason because we need it as humans. We're better off physiologically, psychologically, mentally, better off when we connect with nature. And I'll show you a few different elements of how that actually works. So we should be able to do it get all of our infrastructure shifted to do it. There's green walls that we can possibly do. The High Line New York City is a great example of a piece of old infrastructure that was converted into a greenway. What that's done to property values along the High Line is just extraordinary too, I might say. And so you talk about uplift in property values, that's incredible, just by adding that piece of amenity. Lots of different examples from all over the world where people are actually shifting and doing those sorts of things. But obviously one of the big improvements of being able to connect us with nature, particularly if you're putting nature back into our cities, is that it'll have an effect of increasing biodiversity and stabilising ecological systems, which is one of those megatrends that CSIRO indicated was going the wrong way. There are a whole lot of other benefits that might be available to various creatures. Insufficient nature in our cities, the poor old dogs. Therapy of walking within nature, you'll see this particular graph on the side here. Every single one of those indicators is improved when you go for a walk in nature. So depression, anger, tension, confusion, fatigue, vigour, every single one of those that has a positive movement will go positively if you somehow connect with nature. Nature makes us more generous, another piece of research that was done. Urban farming, there's lots of opportunities to not only have nature but to grow food, to look after some of those other challenges of, you know, potential big food disasters into the future. Here's a little slide from the various academics from around the world postulating about how vertical farms might look in an urban setting. Improvement in water management, efficiency and recycling. There's some culverts, drains in Seattle that's been done. So instead of a concrete drain, they put a lovely little culvert there. So not only does it make everything much nicer, it works pretty well as well. Decreased heat intensity through reduced heat island effect. If you consider climate change as an issue and how we might adapt to some of this enormous amount of heat stress that we're, particularly Adelaide and Melbourne, seem to go through on a more regular basis every year now, bringing nature into our cities will be a huge one. There's just a couple of numbers demonstrating that economic evidence about property uplift and a whole lot of things. This one here was the Cool Communities Program in LA. Estimated annual savings, $170 million a year from reduced air conditioning needs. When you also consider some of the other issues in relation to rising temperatures, so not only if temperatures keep going up, our air conditioning systems obviously get less able to cope, so you need bigger ones which draw more energy, which emit more, so it's a big cycle. Improved health and wellbeing, that's, for me, that this is the biggest opportunity, and there's lots of economic evidence around the world to demonstrate you know, the sorts of effects that connecting with nature have. There's some great books out there, Nature Deficit Disorder, around, that's about kids, you know, their need to connect with nature. There's, you'll notice that all of the new hospitals in Australia at the moment, whenever any of those are being built, they're all built with views, they've all got lots of green spaces in them because of the research demonstrates that the patients actually heal quicker, they can get them out, they can get more turnaround because of all of those sorts of elements. So there's an enormous number there's a lot of evidence out there that suggests all of that. Biophilic cities and creativity, so right brain cities particularly. So there's another opportunity, some more research demonstrating that. Again, a reference to Richard Florida. And I think one of the biggest ones of all is this opportunity for biosequestration of CO2. There are no plans at the moment in how we actually reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that's already in the atmosphere. Yes, there's lots of conversations about how we reduce our emissions, but not about how we get what's there out again. Well, if we create the opportunities through nature, perhaps we might be able to achieve that through biosequestration. So sustainable energy in cars, I've talked about some of those issues, hybrids, smart grids, fewer cars, less roads, urban growth containment, transit-oriented development, just increasing density and putting it close to transport, basically. Green buildings, smaller houses, again, it's a density conversation. Urban farming, biophilic cities. Got to go back to place. All of those things, as you hopefully will have taken note of, all keep coming back to those three elements as well. Well, certainly the last one, the aesthetics one, certainly with the biophilia, but the social offerings and the openness are very important components of how we need to think about how to plan our cities. Each of those communities, as I said before, showed stronger population growth and desirable vitality attributes. And the results. So what are we trying to achieve? Business and finance. So that attraction of financial capital, social capital, attraction and retention of that. Reduced congestion, another financial gain. Increased productivity, yet again. Social equity issues. The savings in the healthcare, get rid of that unfunded liability that's sitting out there at the moment. And obviously also have a positive impact in relation to our greenhouse gas emissions and energy usage. And that's it. Thank you very much.